This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. Well, Fran Lebowitz has always loved to talk, from getting a Band-Aid taped across her mouth in kindergarten, accused of being a chatterbox, to filming an entire Netflix series devoted to her musings. Fran has never been shy to tell the world what she really thinks. For decades, the writer, public speaker, and loyal New Yorker has charmed audiences with her razor-sharp wit and biting social commentary on everything from sidewalk etiquette to the rise of the far right. Fran's bringing that trademark snark back to Canada. She has an appearance at Toronto's Roy Thomson Hall this Thursday. Right now, though, Fran is here. Fran Lebowitz, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Let's start here. I know you don't go on the internet, so I did it for you. I Googled, why is Fran Lebowitz famous? And here's, I know there's algorithms, but here was what came up as my top result. Quote, in the four decades since publishing her wry essay collections, Metropolitan Life and Social Studies, Fran Lebowitz has remained famous simply by talking. So Fran, what do you love so much about talking to people?
Oh, I didn't say to people. I don't know. I just like to talk. I mean, and also it's easier than writing.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to like to talk, but the other part of talking, if you are talking to people or animals, I suppose, is that they have to be interested in what you are talking about. So when did you kind of go, huh, it's not just that I like to talk, it's that people like to hear what I'm saying. When did that sort of dawn for you?
Truthfully, I don't think of it this way. I know everyone else does, but that's probably because I just don't think of it. I started, what I'm doing in Toronto next week, that I started doing, I would say, in the early 80s, because I used to give readings, and then after a while, the book I was reading from was too old in my mind at reading, and I was doing a speaking date in San Francisco, and I said to the person running the theater, you know, I don't want to read from this book. Why don't I just talk? Why doesn't someone just interview me? And she said, what do you mean? I said, someone could just interview me and then I could just talk to the audience. And she said, you mean like on a television talk show? So I said, I guess. Now, I know no one will believe this. Of course, now tons of people do this now. But I invented it. I realize it's not the electric light bulb. And that's how I started doing it.
Okay, see, great. Yeah, I'll put you up there in world's best inventors, this one for talking. I would say, though, friend, that the art of conversation is simply that. It's art. It's not just about talking willy-nilly and saying nothing. There is a sort of dance that needs to be done. And people have been wanting to hear you and watch you do that dance for many, many, many years. So when you're out at parties or just visiting a friend, what makes a good conversation to you?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, obviously, if I'm in a social situation, other people are also talking. So that makes a big difference. I know this doesn't sound, I guess, true, but I don't think about talking, which is probably why I like doing it. I don't think about it. I don't, like, some, you know, when I go into a theater, if I've never been there before, which is ever less likely, sometimes the person in the theater will say, do you have your, you know, notes? Do you need the light on? And I say, no, I don't have anything. I don't prepare. I just make it up as it happens. And so, I mean, a lot of this is pure sloth on my part. You know, I'm lazy. I found out I can do this. I can actually, you know, make a living doing this. And so I do it.
And so when you're on the receiving side of a conversation, like when you're the listener, like what do you like people engaging? What sort of is like, wow, they're a great talker? Because we always talk about you being a great talker, but you got to be a great listener to be a great talker. So what's that captivates you?
Well, I really enjoy people who are funny. which is not the same thing as people who think they're funny. And the problem is that most people, not just most people that I might meet, I'm always startled by how frequently that what people say just slides off your ear. And that's because people just say things they already heard or read. So when someone says something that I haven't heard before or read before, it attracts my attention.
You talked about and continue to talk about, but this comes from your book, Social Studies, back in 1981. You wrote, quote, "Great people talk about ideas, average people talk about things, and small people talk about wine."
Yeah, well, this is true. Unfortunately, I number among my close friends, three of whom I would describe as wine lunatics. And so although I enjoy seeing them and going to dinner with them, I just realized I'm going to spend half the night not listening to the conversation with the wine steward.
Someone told me today they went out with a friend of mine the other day, and I said, "Oh, how did you guys have a good time? It was for a birthday." She said, "Yeah, we had a great survey. They taught us all about structured wine." And my eyes glazed over, and I thought, I don't want to hear any more about that because I don't know what that is.
No, yeah. I don't want to hear anything about it. Okay. I mean, I don't think of this really. I know that it's fascinating to many people, but I don't drink. I stopped drinking when I was 19. Maybe if I was drinking, I would find it more interesting, but I doubt it.
Yeah, fair enough. People who are listening to you now, many of them have been listening to you and following you for decades, from reading your books to watching your late night appearances. But in 2021, you found, I don't know, a fresh fame, if I can put it that way, among millennials and Gen Zs after you did this doc series with Martin Scorsese. It was called Pretend It's a City. What is it like for you to have so many younger fans now? Because you're a queen, man.
Oh, well, they're not really. You know, although people didn't notice, I always had young fans. Of course, since the Netflix series, I just simply have many more fans. You know, many more people are aware of me naturally because people would obviously prefer to watch something than to read something. But also because Pretend It's a City came out during the lockdown worldwide. And, you know, that was very beneficial to the series. I mean, it wasn't beneficial to the world. It was horrible, I know. But, you know, it came out and it was should have come out like a year before. But Netflix kept postponing it. And so it came out, you know, by chance during the lockdown. And it turns out everyone in the world except me was watching Netflix. I've never seen Netflix because you have to have a Wi-Fi connection in your apartment, which I don't. And so although I've always done this, you know, like what I'm doing in Toronto, I've always done the United States and Canada always. But until Netflix, I never did it. I do it everywhere now.
And so as these young people come to you, a lot of them say they want advice from you. What kinds of topics, things, ideas do they usually ask you about?
Many people who are young, which is almost everyone but me, they want very often, even in the street, you know, they want personal advice, like what they should do with their life. Which, when it first started happening, which was actually before the Netflix series, I thought, why would you ask me? You know, I mean, and I finally decided that the reason they do that is because people that age, people like in their early 20s, their parents paid so much attention to them that they think old people care about them. I mean, I don't care what you do. I don't know you. You know, also, that age person, their parents liked them much more than our parents liked us. And so they just feel very comfortable about this. And so they do. They ask me all the time, what do you think I should do? And they also stop me a lot to ask, oh, I wish I lived in New York in the 70s. It seemed like it was so much more fun than now. Uh-huh. And this happened so much that I really started thinking about it. And I tried to think, well, was New York more fun in the 70s than it is now? I mean, you know, I finally decided, you know, I was in my 20s in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So I do know that it was certainly more fun to be in your 20s in the 70s than in your 70s in the 20s, which I am now. But I also know that, you know, I didn't stop people in the street when I was in my 20s to say, oh, I wish I lived in New York in the 30s. So to have nostalgia, which I think is a horrible thing, period, but to have it for something that you didn't live through is kind of bizarre. And that probably is from the internet, because they see all this stuff on the internet, which, although I don't have it and I don't look at it, it has, I am aware, a very flattening effect, which is if you look at, you know, images, it doesn't matter when they're from. You know, it seems the same. It could be something, you know, from 1972 or something from 1872 or something from 2000, you know, 24, whatever. And so I think that's why they do it.
In fairness to the kids, they aren't asking everyone to give them advice. They're turning to you for advice when they see. Like, they don't stop other people of your vintage on the street and ask them for advice. So there is something about you, your personality, how you carry yourself, your style, that seems to be able to transcend generations. You're not a nostalgia act. So have you thought about that? What it is about you that it doesn't really matter how old people are. They like to get your takes on things.
I really think it's because New York in the 70s has achieved this kind of permanent glamour like Paris in the 20s. And unbeknownst to me, because, you know, of course, when I was in my 20s in the 70s, there were no, you know, iPhones and stuff like that. But apparently, you know, even though I actually have always hated having my photograph taken, which, you know, used to be something you had, you were aware of. Now people take a photograph, you don't even know they did. And I think that people, like someone came up to me in the street a week or so ago with her phone, putting it in my face with a photograph of me from like 1972.
Hmm.
And she said, "Is this you?" And I said, "No, that was me. This is me now." Okay, so.
A lot of people, of course, your younger audience, a lot of them, you know, have seen you online, as you said, through their Wi-Fi connection, watching Netflix, the world of social media, where you have lots of people who talk about you and share things about you. You said, "I don't have a computer, I don't have a smartphone, I don't have the Wi-Fi." Why stay offline?
Well, first of all, when they first invented the kind of computer you'd have in your apartment or your house, it was called a word processor. And a friend of mine got one. She was a screenwriter. And she said, "Oh, you have to come look at this thing. It's fantastic." I went, I looked at it. And I thought, well, this is just a very fast typewriter, which is all it was then. There was no internet then. And I don't know how to type. So I thought, I don't need this. And I don't need anything fast for sure. I write so slowly. I could write my own blood without hurting myself. So I said, and so I don't know how to type, and I still don't know how to type. And so, of course, I didn't know that the whole world would go into these little machines. So it's not really a stance. It's more like, I don't care.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me, though, Fran, because so much of our public conversation, like, you don't have to be online to know that, as you say, the rest of the world is online and talking about it and all that stuff. But you just don't give a hoot, right? You're like, I don't care that everyone else is doing this thing. I got my thing
going. I don't care. I mean, yeah. You know, of course, if I was in my 20s, of course, I would know how to do it. But I'm not. So I don't have to. I mean, you know, I mean, people really think it's a stance, like I'm sort of anti-technology or whatever. I also have had a lifelong aversion to machines of any kind. You know, I'm the kind of person, if a machine breaks, I hit it, then I beg it not to break. You know, so, and sometimes when people hand me their phones, look at this, the second I touch it, it goes off.
So you don't have FOMO, fear of missing out on all this.
I do not.
Yeah.
One thing I know, I'm sure there's many things going on all the time that I'm not at, that I will not be at. But one thing I do not feel is a dearth of experience.
You're listening to the Sunday Magazine. If you're just joining me, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with renowned humorist and writer Fran Lebowitz. Fran, when you come to Canada later this month for your Toronto show, your audience can expect, as all audiences of yours can expect, to hear what's on your mind, including the things that are bothering you. What's bothering you these days? How much time do we have? No.
Yes. I mean, what isn't? I mean, you know, everything's bothering me, I would have to say, which is not the same thing as everyone is bothering me. But now it seems to me like more people are bothered than they used to be. And that is either because things are worse, which they seem worse to me, but, you know, and also people do know about everything now. I mean, not in any depth, I like to point out. Because of the phone, people can find out anything, or, you know, not necessarily the thing they find out is true. So people are very aware of lots of things, including weather in places you don't care about. You know, so, I mean, to me, weather is something that should stay local. Like, I don't care what the weather is if I'm not in it.
So I won't tell you what the weather's going to be like when you come to Toronto, because you don't
care. They don't know. They might tell you one thing, that the people who forecast weather, to me, are among the most incompetent people in the world. Because, basically, they guess. And when they're wrong, which is about 90% of the time, they just laugh.
People have said you are filled with opinions. I'm sure you've heard this your entire life, Fran. Oh, tell us what you really think, Fran. Oh, Fran, you've got opinions. And there seems to be, you know, everyone's got an opinion these days. And you know, feels that they have the right to say it. But that hasn't always been the way. Do you like our kind of more opinionated side, like whether it's on social media or wherever in the real world, where people just tell you what you think, what they think? Do you like that?
I don't mind it. It just, it doesn't matter to me. Truthfully, what other people think is of almost no interest to me. But it's not that people have their own opinions. It's that people believe things that aren't true.
Hmm.
Okay, that is, I don't remember the person who said it. It wasn't me, obviously. You know, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts.
Hmm.
Now people have their own facts. And that is not just, you know, infuriating, but it's, of course, it's clearly dangerous.
That, of course, is especially important to remember when we talk about the politics of your country and the fact that you're in an election cycle this year. You have long been outspoken against Donald Trump. Him aside, though, how would you describe the state of political dialogue in the United States?
It's horrible. I mean, and you can't, unfortunately, you cannot say him aside because he is not wholly, but largely responsible for this. Okay? In other words, most people, when they get caught in a lie, are embarrassed, okay? And that used to be true, all right? This is not true any longer of about half the country. So that, especially, you know, I don't, like, know all the people, but the politicians, the ones that you see in the news and stuff, they don't care that they get caught in a lie. They just don't care, you know? For some reason, this is the instance that comes to my mind, you know, after January 6th, Mitch McConnell, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time, said this is clearly the fault of the president. 5 minutes later, like the next day, he said it's not. Now, he knew they were going to run the, you know, video of him saying it's his fault, and he didn't care.
Hmm.
They don't care. So they, I've always been interested in the fact that the word shameful and shameless mean the same thing. You know, they have no shame. There just seems to be this idea, I'm talking about Republicans because I believe Democrats, not that they're saints and not that they never lie, but they tend to like be embarrassed when they get caught in a lie. It's not a value they hold. Okay? It's as simple as that. You know, in other words, their value system, if you want to call it that, includes nothing at all that used to exist as a value system. So it's just simply, can we get elected? Can we take power? Can we, you know, do these things that we want to do? We don't care if you like them. One thing, I get blamed, I have to say, for things that the government does or politicians do. You know, I happen to have been in London when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And every night, someone from the audience would say, why'd you overturn Roe v. Wade? Why'd you overturn Roe v. Wade? I'm not on the Supreme Court. It's not my fault.
Hmm. You mean as an American citizen, you get held responsible?
Yes, you get blamed so that, you know, I mean, it's not that the United States has always been vastly popular, but, you know, sometimes I would disagree with people who had positions opposed to the positions of the United States. But now I kind of agree with them.
When we look at a lot of the big issues facing your country, mine, I mean, the world, climate change, spread of misinformation, disinformation, growing wealth inequality, I they're big, they're macro. They seemingly seem to be intractable and unfixable. And you get asked about these big things all the time. So in your mind, like, where is a good place to start in conversation to have those conversations and solve some of those problems?
Well, you know, truthfully, like you mentioned before that, you know, kids ask me what they should do with their life. I always say run for something, okay? Because if you look at least at our, the American Congress, if I was in Congress, I'd be like one of the kids. I'm 73, all right? So one of the reasons that the people are so old in government is because people who are young don't run, you know? So run for something. These things can be changed. Anything that humans do can be changed by humans. That's not everything in the world, but it's certainly politics.
Hmm. But you can see and understand why when young people look at the people that are running the palace, not just in your country or your state, or say, why would I want to do that? Like, there's just a lot of crap that comes with that.
Yeah, that's because they don't do anything. At a certain point, guess what? It's your fault. All right? So if you don't run and you don't vote, you know, and you don't take part in it, you know, this is what happens. You know, it's like money. All right? If you don't pay attention to your money, someone else will.
Hmm. Okay, so in this interview that you recently did with Hillary Clinton, she asked you what you want to do next. You joked that you'd be interested in becoming the mayor of New York. What would make you a good mayor?
Oh, I'd be a great mayor. The problem with being the mayor of New York is that I couldn't win, okay? So I wouldn't run knowing I couldn't win, okay? I'm in a room right now with one other person. I doubt I could win this room. So, you know, the mayor of New York is a great job. Unfortunately, of course, we have a horrible mayor. We almost always have had a horrible mayor. I lived in New York for 50 years. In that entire time, there have been two mayors I liked. That's not enough. So I would love to be the mayor of New York, but I'm not going to be the mayor of New York because I couldn't win.
Why not?
Why not?
Yeah, why can't you win?
You know, because I am not everyone's cup of tea. In fact, I'm not enough people's cup of tea in order to win. All right, even in New York, because, you know, like, I'm just not.
Yeah.
I know that. All right, there's certain things I know, certain things I don't know. I know I couldn't win.
Yeah, that's good self-awareness there, that you're some people's, they want a lot of Fran tea and some people are just like, no, thank you, I'll take coffee. But you also said you'd be a good mayor. So what would make you a good mayor?
Well, first of all, I'd be a very good mayor.
Oh, fair enough.
Okay, because I actually care about the city and because I actually know the city in ways that most mayors don't. Most mayors might know part of the city, you know, but I wouldn't say every square inch, but close. And I know what's wrong and I know how it could be fixed. All right. I mean, and I know that this could be done if people would just do what I say.
So you're saying to people, run and get, you know, run for office to change the world. And you say, I'd be really good at this, but no, thank you, because I won't win.
Yeah, but I'm 73. Let me assure you that what we don't need is more old politicians. Okay? So, because what really surprises me is, this is, I don't know if it's true in Canada, it's true here, that people who are in their 20s proportionally vote less frequently than older people, which is really stupid because, you know, no matter how bad the future looks to me, for me, the future also, to me, is not that long. So, you know, if I was in my 20s, I'd be a lot more upset than I am now.
I want to go back to something you wrote in your book, Social Studies. You wrote, think before you speak, read before you think. Do you still believe that's the best way forward for people to listen to each other, get smarter, have better conversations, talk, listen, all those things?
Absolutely.
No.
I mean, absolutely, reading is, for me personally, it's the most important thing, okay? It's also the thing I like to do the most. But reading makes the world huge, okay? I mean, I lived in a little town. I grew up in a little town. And the second I learned to read, it didn't matter I lived in a little town. And when people say, well, I don't want to read that, you know, oh, that came out, that book is 100 years old. But the reason that there are some 100-year-old books you wouldn't want to read, for sure. There are also some 100-minute-old books that I don't want to read. But, you know, the reason there are books still in print from 100 years ago is because how great they are.
Listen, we look forward to having you here in Toronto and appreciate you making time for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the witty Fran Lebowitz. She'll be at Toronto's Roy Thomson Hall this Thursday. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.